And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today as we're here every day. Every time we do this podcast, we don't do this podcast every day, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And we are here today with my good friend, Mr. Doug O'Brien. Doug O'Brien has been involved as a Catholic in all kinds of good works for the least of these since forever, and so I thought it would be great to have him on the show this week to talk about our duty to the least of these and how radically this Congress just failed that duty. What we can do as Catholics to help the least of these, now that for the time being, our state representatives have decided to flip the least of these a massive middle finger. So, Doug, hello, how are you?
Hello, Mark, I'm doing fine, thank you.
Good, good. We've known each other now for what, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, I think, something like that.
For a long time.
Yeah. You used to work at Marytown.
I used to work for the Franciscans, yes, at Marytown.
Out in Chicago, where you live, and that's how I got to know you was through going to Marytown. Used to go out there. My wife and I would get invited out for their end of the year Militia Immaculata retreats. We were the adorable old couple. That would come out and do our thing, and I remember walking through the Maximilian Kolbe Shrine, holding hands with Jan one evening, and there were like these. There was a couple of like young things who were there for the Militia Immaculata retreat, and they were like giggling behind us because we were old people holding hands. And it was adorable, and it's like, okay, we're officially cuddly old people now. So, there you go. So how you been?
I've been well. And yourself?
Good, good. Did you have a good Thanksgiving and proper beginning to Advent?
It really was, and Advent has begun well. So yeah.
Good, good. What do you have? Do you have Advent customs that are beyond the norm, like Advent candles? And I mean, everybody does Advent candles, and do you do other things?
Well, we have one which I'm sure is not unique to us, but it feels that way, is that we have the Saturday before the first Sunday of Advent scrambling through all the boxes in the attic to find the allegedly was marked appropriately Advent to find the Advent wreath. And again, that's happened pretty consistently for about 15 years. So we did find the Advent wreath, and we did get it up in time. We did our family prayers and blessings over the wreath, and we have this other maybe more unique tradition, which is we have a cardboard book that has little biblical stories associated with Advent to be read every day. And so the problem is that every year we think that we've gotten all these little books, 25 in all, of course, and put back in their appropriate slots to be read. And, of course, we have the problem where there's always two or three missing, and the mad scramble to find in which box they may have ended up. and then, of course, the dinner time battle between the two youngest kids, whose turn it is to read, yeah.
Okay. So all of that. Yeah. Well, you know, what would Christmas be without a little bit of chaos? So
yeah, a little bit. Yeah. That whole silence and preparation has not been on a successful part of our journey for many years.
Yeah. Well, you know, that goes with having a big Catholic family too. So,
yeah. Six kids. That complicates it.
It brings noise. You know, it's part of the deal. is noise with childhood. So, well, you know, that's good. That's good. Well, I thought I'd have you on the show today because I thought it would be good as Catholics to talk about, especially during this Advent season, you know, when we I've been saying now for a while that Christians celebrate Advent, and what I call Christianists, that is, people who use the trappings of Christianity in order to pursue a political agenda that is radically alien to the Christian vision, celebrate the war on Christmas. And so we hear this time of year about the war on Christmas, but, you know, we're not really living in a police state where it's forbidden to say Merry Christmas. There's this weird myth that we are, but we're not. But, I mean, the real war on Christmas is the war on the least of these, as far as I'm concerned. There's a famous story of St. Lawrence. The Roman authorities came to St. Lawrence because they heard rumors that the Christian church had vast treasures hidden, you know, somewhere. And so they came to St. Lawrence, who was a deacon in the church at Rome, and they said, bring us your treasures. He said, okay, be back here in 24 hours. I will bring you our treasures. And so the Roman authorities showed up the next day, hoping to get a big ton of gold. And he brought out all the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame, and said, here's our treasures, which the Roman authorities didn't find funny at all. And so they executed St. Lawrence for that. But that is the treasures of the church. And in the last few days, what we've witnessed is a GOP-dominated Congress, which deliberately chose to rob the least of these, cutting things like children's health. I mean, health care for poor children. They cut that. They cut Meals on Wheels, calling it an act of compassion. And they made it clear they're coming next. They're coming for Medicare. They're coming for Social Security. They're going to take all of that, which we paid into, and they're going to give it to the top 1% in tax cuts. This is a huge act of theft from the least of these, and I wanted to talk with you about that. What can we do as citizens?
Yeah, I laugh because this is, this is difficult. One, I think first, and you're doing a great public service by just helping people better understand. I think tax policy and budget resolutions, when you talk about those with your friends over drinks, their eyes begin to glaze over and quickly want to change the subject. It's challenging. And I'd say that I think all of the analysis, serious analysis on both the budget resolution and the tax bill, isn't really fully complete, and it's not necessarily settled, meaning that there's not complete agreement on the effects of one cut versus another. Some are pretty obvious, like you said, is that when you cut Medicare, Medicare and Medicaid, it's likely. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, sorry. Is it when you allow for reductions, or what I'd say budget, chicanery, in which you say we'll give the states flexibility on how they do it, which invariably means the states will make their cuts. You create an environment for those cuts to in fact happen. You know, when you have Congress has rules that require it to, and which they can change, but they have rules that say that if you make increases in the budget deficit, you have to find savings somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And when you look tax cuts and the budget resolution, which allows for the tax cuts, is that invariably those savings or those cuts will come on programs that help the least of these, as you said. Mm-hmm. Ones that don't have armies of lobbyists or tax accountants and lawyers to help them navigate both individually or as a class the halls of Congress to make sure that those preferred provisions are protected. So kids, yeah, CHIP is cut, Medicaid and Medicare are likely cut, and then there's a whole series of, you mentioned Meals on Wheels, there's a whole series of other programs that on the face of it, like cutting the community development block grant or social services block grant, doesn't seem necessarily onerous if you're but when you drill down, you see what those programs actually are. It is, in fact, Meals on Wheels and programs for the homeless and after school provisions, et cetera, that, right. that end up. Oh. That makes sense.
You cut out at the end. That end up.
That end up getting, what was it? That end up getting whacked.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there are a number of things that I think. People hear that are they're kind of tropes that you hear over and over again. So one of them is, you know, the problem with state-sponsored, you know, help for the poor is that it robs us of the chance to be personally charitable. Jesus never said. We hear this a lot. Jesus never said, you know, anything about the state taking care of people. He tells us to do it. And that's true. But you know what? Jesus also tells us to pay our taxes. In fact, Jesus himself paid a number of taxes because he was, you know, part of the people of Israel, and the people of Israel had systems for helping the least of these. I think the problem with the whole, you know, welfare ruins my chance to be charitable argument is what it really does. I think it's an expression of profound narcissism. So, for example, one of the things that I hear people say is we shouldn't have a state-sponsored healthcare safety net because that robs me of the chance to be personally charitable. Well, first of all, no, it doesn't. Of course it doesn't. You can be as personally charitable as you like. But what you're really saying and what I witness every day on the internet is people who – have some desperate health care problem. Their daughter has leukemia. They got a 4-year-old girl with leukemia. And what? How do I know about it? Because they're forced to busk on the internet. They have to go on the internet and beg through a GoFundMe for people to be nice enough to help them face their, you know, whatever it is, $2 zillion medical costs that it's going to take to save their daughter's life. And so what you're really saying when you say a state-sponsored social safety net healthcare system like they have in Australia, for example, or Canada or the UK, what you're really saying is I am so selfish about wanting to have the feeling of being generous that I am willing to force a family to busk on the internet and hope and pray that somebody will give them enough money so that they don't have to watch their daughter die. I would rather have that family be forced to do that and maybe watch their daughter die than to have a couple of bucks taken out of my paycheck. That's what that argument boils down to. That's what we always wind up saying when we say that it's got to be a choice between a state-sponsored social safety net or me being personally charitable. What the church commends to us is both. Have a social safety net, also be as charitable as you can be. You've been working with Feeding the Homeless. How does this affect what you're trying to do?
Well, before I just want to say that the one thing, you know, you call them the Christianists, and the part of that, you know, they frequently, as you've pointed out, like to wrap themselves in the mantle of the unborn to justify otherwise bad policy behavior elsewhere, right?
Right.
But in one of the underlying arguments of the protection of the unborn is the dignity of the human person made in the image of God.
Right.
That when you cut these programs for the poor, or maybe people who aren't poor but suddenly find themselves because of a catastrophic health condition or situation, you actually undermine the dignity of those people.
Right.
You're required to go out onto the street, humiliate themselves, in the case of the street being, you know, the digital street. You require them to go out and beg alms so they can keep a family member alive, or they can provide dinner for their family that night, or that they may have a house to call, you know, or warmth in the winter. And so, you know, that kind of belies the problem with this Christianist. And I want to again say not Christians themselves, the Catholics, but this kind of fake Christianity that attacks these programs, because those programs at the federal and state level are actually an extension of protecting the dignity of the people that find themselves in some sort of need. And the program, so to get to your question, the programs that we serve, or sorry, that I work on, like with food banks, just to give you a sense why charity isn't really the solution. Food banks are less than 1/6 of the food assistance provided to more than 40 million low-income people in America. And yet, despite the fact that we have 40 million low-income people in America that get help, is that we still have high hunger rates, higher hunger rates than other highly industrialized countries. In fact, we are at the bottom of food security among wealthy nations, tied with Korea, South Korea.
Okay.
Other nations have done fabulously well. We haven't. And so we really do need the state, which is an extension of our will to take care of the least of these, mm-hmm. coupled with charity. But charity can't replace it. It is a fraction. And it obviously, if food banks were full of dollars pouring in and food pouring in, maybe a stronger argument could be made. But you know, anyone that opens their mailbox about this time of year, they're seeing the regular appeals of these charities saying we need help to really just keep from going underwater and trying to serve the people we are. So the budget and the taxes and the policy proposals that are out there, unfortunately, many of them look like they're going to make the situation worse and not better. Now,
right. The
argument being made by the proponents of these policies is that it will vastly improve the economy, and with a vastly improved economy that people won't need these programs. And then that's possible, though history doesn't seem to suggest that's in fact true. And that, again, kind of belies this kind of gamble that's going on with people's lives, whether it be in healthcare or in food assistance, housing policy, caring for people who have addictions, or it doesn't matter. It seems to be a pretty much across the board. If you are poor and vulnerable, you are in the crosshairs of this budget and these tax policies.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah, and yeah, that it's true. That's the story you always hear is, you know, it's the old trickle-down thing. You know, if we give a colossal tax cut to the 1%, then it's all going to trickle down in terms of new jobs and et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, what you immediately see are corporations giving the money all goes to their investors. It doesn't go to their employees.
Right.
You know, and I just today I was, you know, I was looking on Facebook, and what amazes me is the gloating that happened. So McDonald's is now putting in machines to replace the people that take your orders. And the big gloat is, ha ha, this is what you get for asking for $15 an hour. And it's gloating. This is what you get, is the logic, for asking for a living wage. You should be punished. And it's very much, you know, that McDonald's is right to do this. That McDonald's is right to lay off workers and, you know, do this spitefully in order to deny them a living wage, while of course the executives who run McDonald's are giving themselves, you know, gazillion dollar bonuses and so on and so forth. And you know what we're talking about here is an economics that puts people first rather than merely gain.
Yes, and that first. Actually has been. And that's baked in to Catholic social teaching, and has been stated and restated by the last three popes.
Is right.
That Economies exist for people, not people for economies, right?
Yes.
And while I, who maybe tend more towards allowing companies, if they want to replace workers, to replace them, that's fine. But there has to be some sort of protection for those workers, right? And so is it, look, if McDonald's, wants to automate systems, okay, I guess in a free society, you can allow a business to automate systems. However, those people who do lose their jobs should not then also lose all kinds of protections to their human dignity and their actual existence. All right? Losing a job does not mean that you should then be homeless or hungry and without insurance.
Right.
And there's some obligation for all parts of society, whether it be business that tries to become more efficient, or so stated, the wealthiest of us, and just normal taxpayers to make sure that we provide a right. basic safety net to maintain the dignity of the people, of our neighbors, of our brothers.
Right. And this really does come back then to, you know, what we're talking about is being fully pro-life.
Did I lose you again?
I say what this comes back to is that we're really talking about being fully pro-life, not merely anti-abortion, not merely pro-life up until the moment a baby is born, and then from that moment on, that baby is a parasite, and so is his mother, and what we need to do is, you know, cut her medical benefits and, you know, cut his health care if he's a poor kid. And so we have to start thinking as pro-life people about what it means to be fully pro-life, to be committed to the dignity of the human person from conception to natural death. And an awful lot of us are not doing that.
In fact, we may actually be advancing their natural death. But not
absolutely
providing these basic services.
Sure.
That's the problem. I will say this. It is, to me, extraordinarily frustrating to see people who share my view on the sanctity of human life turn around in the very same sentence or the very same conversation, complaining about these very programs that protect human life. And, you know, food assistance is not a luxury. It's not. It's necessary. We must eat, right?
Right.
The data, by the way, just to give an example, is that these programs that cut, for example, or I should say that potentially, because it's not law yet, and there's still a chance to change these things. But these programs that provide child nutrition services, why that matters is that we know from just an overwhelming amount of data that kids that have adequate nutrition for prenatal, after birth, all the way to age 6, those are critical years for brain development, overall health, educational attainment. Just it's a critically important stage in a children's life. And it seems to me to be absurd to say that I am a follower of Christ and that suddenly after birth, I no longer care about the outcome of my poor brother or sister.
Right.
That's the absurdity. And that's why, you know, these aren't simply these are real life consequences of policies that really should upset us, not for larger economic things, but actually for the state of our own souls.
Sure. Yeah, because it really is. It's about, you know, saving the lives of these children after they're born. I mean, that's really what we're talking, you know, and we understand it's weird because we understand the idea of a crisis pregnancy center. Okay, so you know, if you're going to care about human life, you have to care about mom. But you know, I've got friends who went through crisis pregnancies, and they say, you know, the pro-life movement was really helpful to me up until about, you know, a couple of months after my baby came. And yeah. After that, it was just like, okay, you got your diapers, you know, to last you for 6 weeks. But now we're voting for all of these candidates who are doing everything they can to make sure that you will live in poverty for the rest of your life. And, you know, that's crazy. That's a crazy approach. And so one of the things...
And then the injury, by the way, on that is that... And then to complain about, for example, welfare cheats, and they're not pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. And, you know, there really is a cruel irony to this rhetoric. When you have the director of the Office of Management and Budget, who evidently also wants to run the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau because he has so much time. When these guys say that they're somehow being compassionate by cutting the program that helps fund Meals on Wheels, it's shocking. Just yesterday was in a conversation with a policymaker on the discussion about welfare dependency, which invariably comes from people who have never been on welfare and have no idea that people really don't want to be dependent on these programs because, you know what? They're not really generous. They really are, at best, sustaining, right?
Right.
The average stamp benefit is $1 per person per meal. Yeah. I don't know people that can provide for their family with that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's the great lie, of course, is that there are people who are, you know, that the system is being massively gamed, and people on welfare love being on welfare. People on welfare hate being on welfare, and they would love to get off welfare as soon as they possibly can.
Well, and the cruel irony for some of these programs are that if you work, you are actually de-incentivized, right? It is mm-hmm. that as you have earnings, like in the, for example, in the, it's called SNAP, but it's formerly the food stamp program.
Right.
Is that as your earnings increase, your benefit decreases, right?
Right.
And so, an already meager benefit becomes even more meager because you have some income coming in. Now, there are some places in some states that are trying to change that by their own policies. But in the long term, talking about growing the economy and how these tax cuts will have the impact. In the long term, there's less money coming into the federal government, period. That's the long-term effect.
Right.
That means then that you will have to make cuts, right, to pay for this debt, for this lack of income coming into the federal government. And invariably, those cuts fall on the backs of poor people.
Right.
And that means that there won't be increases in SNAP benefits, and there won't be increases in WIC that provides food assistance for pregnant women and their infants. There won't be additional funding. At best, or what is more likely, if history is any guide, those programs will see reductions and cuts because we have to pay for these tax cuts somehow. Again, what I'm trying to say is this tax policy debate that's going on right now really is very much an anti-life position.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And what we get in return for it as pro-life people – you know, what I'm continually told is, well, yes, but the Supreme Court, it's super important, you know, and that's why we have to vote for these people, because real soon now they're going to overturn Roe versus Wade. Here's the bad news that really needs to be faced by people living in the real world. Roe versus Wade is never going to be overturned. And in fact, Roe versus Wade is the construct of Republican appointees to the Supreme Court. Roe versus Wade was written by a Republican appointee, and everything that's been done to strengthen Roe versus Wade was done by Republican appointees.
I'll just say this, is that, so you're trying to say, not you, but those advocates of that position, are they trying to say that we should bring a pedophile to the United States Senate because he might be able to put a Supreme Court justice on that might at some point in the future overturn Roe v. Wade?
Yes, that's exactly what they're saying.
that's
precisely what they're saying. And they said the same thing about putting a sex predator in the White House.
Right. And oddly, my lord was given a similar proposition in which he was just asked to jump off the top of the temple. That he would get all this other great stuff.
That's right.
And that's kind of the analogy that runs through my head.
Well, you know, when Trump was running, he literally said, you know, when I'm president, Christianity will be powerful again. You won't need anybody but me, he said. And I was like, Yeah, you know, I've heard this before, right?
Sure.
Just, I will give you all the kingdoms of the earth if you'll just bow down before me.
Yep.
And that is the deal that we keep accepting as pro-life people. And so as a result, what we've been taught over the last 30 years as pro-life people is not... It was proposed to us by Cardinal Bernardine, actually, in what was called the Seamless Garment Doctrine. Basically, what he did was he restated the teaching of the church, which said that the way we treat the unborn is related to the way we treat all the rest of the least of these. And so we have to recognize that these things are all related, that our attitude to the death penalty, to a living wage, to poor people, to unjust war, and all the rest of it is all related to our attitude to the unborn. And instead, what's happened over the last 30 years is the pro-life conservative Christian, both evangelical and Catholic, has been taught and has deeply internalized the idea that the unborn, our interest in abortion and our interest in the unborn is the opposite of and opposed to everything else in the church's social teaching. And so the unborn, you know, you can go ahead and cheat people of a living wage because the living wage isn't as important as abortion. Torture, not as important as abortion. The death penalty, not as important as abortion. And so every time you relate these things, you're told, no, all those things are liberal things. And liberal things are the opposite of concern for the unborn. So we can ignore and, in fact, fight against actively the church's teaching. This, by the way, you see this all over the place with the loathing of Pope Francis.
Yeah, and actually, as you're saying this, I was thinking back. You know, back in the day when I worked in Washington on the Hill, is that there was a commonality of people of deep and of deep faith, regardless of party, to agree on certain things, right?
Right.
Is that what I've seen over my adult life is really kind of a weird transformation that I would argue is actually quite sinister. Mm-hmm. And that is, it is that increasingly my party affiliation or my political ideology seems to overwhelm my gospel conscience, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. So Bernardine, who's a cardinal, suddenly becomes a stalking horse for those on the right, right? And so, right. And, you know, if I look at my social media feeds, is that very devout and good and faithful Catholics who I count as friends increasingly are carrying on this rhetoric that attacks Bernardine's, you know, again, as you said, restatement of what has been a consistent ethic throughout the 2,000 years of the church,
right,
is now painted that as some sort of a political agenda,
right,
that is contrary to the gospel,
right,
and only we have now the same criticisms of the Pope coming, shockingly, from our own pews,
yeah,
from people who call themselves very devout Catholics,
right.
But I don't know how you can be Catholic if you are not in communion with Cesar Peter.
With the Holy Father, exactly.
I mean,
and the idea that he's saying something deeply un-Catholic, you know. And, you know, and the spectacle, for example, of watching people who are absolutely obsessed with a footnote in a document called Amoris Laetitia that the vast majority of Catholics have never read. And
right.
They're terribly, and they have this bizarre notion that Pope Francis is somehow, he's the enemy of the faith, the enemy of the family. And then in the next breath, these same people will say, and you must vote for child molester Roy Moore, who can save us, you know. That's crazy. And it's this kind of weird topsy-turvy picture of things. You know, I think Bernardine was simply right when he said, look, all of these teachings of the church are all related. The fate of the unborn and our attitude to the unborn and to the rights of the unborn is totally related to, not opposed to, our attitude to the poor, to the hungry, to the jobless, to the homeless, you know, to vets who are living on the street, who are forced into suicide, to disabled people. You know, one of the effects of the new budget is going to be to make it much harder for the disabled to get training, job training that they want. And at the same time that we're denying the disabled the ability to get jobs, we're also cutting benefits for the disabled because they're welfare parasites and they need to go get jobs. It's crazy.
It is crazy. And the thing is this, we should all, you know, when you're talking about our concern is that it really is. It should not be a debatable point that we as Catholics have a concern, or even as often stated, the preference for the poor, right, is that least among us is it is so apparent and clear in the gospel and the Old Testament that our concern for the poor is part of a necessary part of our faith, that it really should not be debated. Right. But I would say even there should be a concern for the rich too. Mm-hmm. And the concern for the rich is the burden they carry. The burden they carry, you know, Christ was pretty clear about the warning to people about if you are so blessed by God, how those blessings must be used, right? Mm-hmm. That a great responsibility is placed upon you. And what you see with this budget policy is not just people like me saying, have compassion for the poor, but it's also saying you are actually failing those 1% to take on your own discipleship burden, which is that unless you're going to be opening food banks, unless you're going to be you know, providing for goodwill so that disabled people and those with Down syndrome can have fulfilling lives, unless you're really going to take on those responsibilities, you are in fact not living out a Christian ethic.
Right.
And I would just say that you know, the problem is this is, as we began, it was just, this is now fully ingrained in the American church, is that you just see too often that people presume that my pro-life stance makes me a Republican, which makes me then, by extension, in support of these policies. And in fact, these policies work against my very faith in Christ.
Yes, and that's one of the, you know, that's one of the things that I think is so crucial for us to grasp. St. John Chrysostom has a number of really, for me, very terrifying commentaries on the relationship between the rich and the poor. So he says, for example, that if you do not find Christ in the beggar at the church door, you will not find him in the chalice.
Right.
And he also says, I think in the single greatest summary I've ever heard from a Christian perspective of the real relationship between rich and poor, you really want to understand what's going on. What he says is the rich exist for the sake of the poor. And then he says the poor exist for the salvation of the rich. And so as Archbishop Chaput says, and I wish that Catholics in Congress like Paul Ryan were listening to him, he says, if you neglect the poor, you will go to hell.
Well, how more obvious can it be than the gospel writers who tell the story of the rich man that comes to Jesus and says, I go faithful to temple. I follow all the rules. And what does Jesus say to him? Sell everything you have and give it to the poor.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no more example, right?
He didn't really mean that, though.
And so what I'm getting at is that's not just a cute gospel story that a priest may or may not, you know, base a homily on. It actually impacts policy, right? So if there's a proposal in Congress now to give more money to rich people, right? To make tax cuts for all Americans.
Yeah.
To their statement. Then there is a greater responsibility on those people so receiving that benefit to give it back then to the poor in very real ways. And I would just say this, human nature and history strongly suggest that is not going to happen.
Right. Yeah. So as somebody who has worked with Feeding the Poor, what would you recommend for us, you know, average schmoo in the pew? What can we do?
Well, one, I think being informed is the first thing, is that being aware that tax cuts are much more than just tax cuts. They have long-term impacts on people all across the country, and they will fall disproportionately on those people who are already struggling to have life's basic necessities.
Mm-hmm.
So being informed is the first thing. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, if you are not registered to vote, please register to vote.
Right.
That is critical. Thirdly, is that communicating with policymakers at all levels on how important concern for the poor is, and that any kind of tax legislation or budget policy proposals that move forward should always keep in mind, because you as a person of faith care about that, right?
Yeah.
Too often the debate has been people of faith versus people of not faith, right? That's certainly what's playing out in Alabama right now, is that Doug Jones is viewed as the is a person who is just not Christian enough. And so as a Christian, you got to vote for Roy Moore.
I saw an ad for him the other day that said, Doug Jones also has a past that involves little girls. He prosecuted the church bombers who killed four little black girls.
Oh, there you go.
And that's the thing that it's come to this, that we're in a place where people are like, well, yeah, he's a child molester, but Doug Jones is a real problem. It's like, Doug Jones, yes, he's a Democrat. He supports abortion. You know what will happen to our abortion rate if Doug Jones is elected? Nothing.
Right.
Because nothing will change. You know what will happen to our abortion rate if Roy Moore is elected? Chances are it's actually going to go up.
Right.
Because when this tax package is passed, what you're going to get is tremendous economic strain on poor people, and that economic strain on poor people is going to drive the abortion rate up because poverty is the number one abortifacient.
Right.
Yeah. But
and the fourth thing I would say, though, very quickly is this, is that people have to come out and vote in November of 2018. Is that, and they have to vote with frankly the gospel in mind, right? They have to vote, think about, my vote is either complicity with evil or it is opposition to evil. And that's really how you have to go into the voting booth, right? And you have to look at it in the holistic way the church teaches. It's not simply abortion. It is the dignity of all people from conception to natural death.
Yes.
And that has to guide the decision when you pull the lever.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it's true. Well, listen, Doug, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our guest today has been Mr. Doug O'Brien, and we are in the thick of Advent, and I look forward to talking to you more as Advent goes on here on Connecting the Dots. Until that time, have a happy Advent. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you, Mark. God bless.
Bye-bye.